Hey everybody, this is Noel Rappin from the Dynamic Rubyist blog, or noelrappin.com, or wherever you got this from. And this is just trying to have fun doing some audio versions of some of the blog posts. Not sure what the audience for this is really, but I do like recording audio. I haven't gotten a chance to do it much recently, and I thought this might, might be interesting to me at least. So this post is When Books Could Code, number one, Design Patterns. The original text version was posted on April 25th, 2026. So I've spent my whole career fascinated by writing about programming books. How do programmers explain what we're doing to each other? How have books written about programming changed the way we work and think? So now I'm writing about programming books. If you think this is somewhat elegiac for the era of the programming book, as the co-author of a 700-page programming book in an era where there will be roughly zero new 700-page programming books, yeah, kinda. So this series, called When Books Could Code, alluding, I guess, obviously, to the If Books Could Kill podcast, making my title the faint echo of somebody else's joke, which somehow seems appropriate. In the same way as the Ruby Neighbor posts did, I'm going to try and give a sense of what the book felt like when it came out, how the book fits into our world, what it changed, and what parts of it hold up or don't hold up. So the book that we're starting with is Design Patterns, Elements of Reusable Object-Oriented Software by Eric Gamma, Richard Helm, Ralph Johnson, and John Vlacidis, I think that's how you say it, who are often referred to as the Gang of Four. It's copyright 1994. All the authors are listed on the back cover as Doctor, which is a bit of a key to what this book actually is. Per the book itself, it started as part of Eric Gamma's PhD thesis. The thesis was apparently about ET++, which was an object-oriented framework for building desktop apps written in C++. As part of the thesis, Gamma apparently created a catalog of useful patterns in the creation of the framework. The catalog spun off as its own thing. The other three authors came into contact with the catalog probably through the Uppsala academic conferences. Uppsala is an academic conference from the Association of Computing Machinery. It's object-oriented programs, systems, and languages, I think is what it is. So they came into contact through that and moved it into its own work, and then eventually that work became a book. It's arguably the most influential programming book that isn't about a specific language and isn't really about a process. I guess other possibilities will be XP Explained, which will be the second book in this series, The Mythical Man Month, Clean Code. I've actually never read Mythical Man Month or Clean Code. Maybe that would be interesting for this series. Anyway, it's impossible to overstate how ubiquitous this book was at one point. I very much remember working at Motorola circa 2005, 10 years after the book came out, and every cubicle had a copy. It's certainly one of the few programming books to have spawned a backlash that was nearly as influential as the book itself. And it still sells. I checked Design Patterns as I look this up currently, has an Amazon ranking of 17,441, which is astonishing for a 20-year-old programming book. Anyway, to my genuine surprise, they've never done a second edition. There are a bunch of offshoot books, though, both official ones and unofficial, including Design Patterns in Ruby from Russ Olson, also the author of Eloquent Ruby. It's worth talking about the timing here, since the book came out in 1994. First, this book predates Java, the programming language. The code examples are in C++ and much more rarely Smalltalk. The book was, however, a huge influence on Java, both the language and the standard library, which is one reason I'm surprised they never did an official second edition with code samples in Java. As a result, the book also predates most of the 90s hype about object-oriented programming, though the book was arguably a contributing factor in that hype. But this does mean the book was written in a context that was much different than the context that most of its readers encountered it in. You might argue that the book was trying to solve a problem that was largely solved by the time many of its readers got to it. My physical copy from 2000 is the 20th printing. Wikipedia says it sold more than 500,000 copies. To provide context, that is well over an order of magnitude more than I have sold total all my books. I'm not actually entirely sure when I encountered it. Wait a second, I can check on that. Please hold on while I dig around in dusty basement bookshelves. I feel like I should do a sound effect here. Russell, 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 Russell. My graduate school work in 1997 and 1998 was using modeling software to teach object-oriented design, and I did, in fact, cite this book in the dissertation. So I clearly read it in 1996 or 1997. This is 1998 me writing in my thesis about why I did not choose to include support for patterns in my modeling software. In addition to some logistical issues, the student programs we were working with were generally too simple to support patterns. I ended with this quote. My experience in attempting to teach design patterns when I taught the OO class was that they were not particularly helpful. The students had not had any experience encountering the kinds of problems that patterns are aimed at solving, so they did not see the need for them, unquote. It is also possible that as a very novice teacher, I was not doing a good job explaining things. Somewhere in my basement, I still have all the final exams from that class, which I should pull out someday. That would be kind of interesting. So, what's the big idea of this book? Like a lot of programming books, the authors lay out their thesis in an introduction that doesn't get read by a lot of people. We quickly get this quote. Experienced object-oriented designers will tell you that a reusable and flexible design is difficult, if not impossible, to get right the first time, unquote. What's striking about this sentence from a 2026 perspective is that depending on your definition of experienced, the number of experienced OO designers in the entire world when this book was being written was pretty small. OO was still a fringe case. C++ was released in 1985, but didn't have a lot of users still in 1994. Smalltalk went public outside Xerox in 1981, but it wasn't really public until 1983, and it was always kind of niche. It was entirely possible to be a professional programmer in 1994 and not touch object-oriented anything. Anyway, you were saying, Gang of Four. Quote, one thing expert designers know not to do is solve every problem from first principles. Rather, they reuse solutions that have worked for them in the past. Consequently, you'll find recurring patterns of classes and communication objects in many object-oriented systems. These patterns solve specific design problems and make object-oriented designs more flexible, elegant, and ultimately reusable, unquote. There's that pattern word. I've threatened a few times to write about the OO hype of the 90s, and the word reuse was a big part of that hype cycle. 90s OO was all about chasing reuse, in the sense that business logic objects created for one program at your organization could be reused as is in other programs. This never really paid off in the way that it was expected to. And off the top of my head, looking at it from 2026, I think that the problem was that the 90s OO designers were thinking at the wrong level. By the 2000s, open source was vast enough that we had extremely substantial and influential reuse, but not of individual business logic classes as much as we got it of entire foundation libraries like Rails or, for that matter, Linux. So I didn't share my user class from program to program, but I did share the underlying HTTP layer logic. So we did get a kind of reuse, but not the kind of reuse that 90s OO designers thought we were going to have. Anyway, I interrupted you again, Gang of Four. Please go on. Quote, an analogy will help illustrate the point. Novelists and playwrights rarely design their plots from scratch. Instead, they follow patterns like tragically flawed hero, Macbeth, Hamlet, etc., or the romantic novel, countless romance novels. In the same way, object-oriented designers follow patterns like represent states with objects and decorate objects so you can easily add or remove features. Once you know the pattern, a lot of design decisions follow automatically, unquote. I don't necessarily think it's a good idea to pick on people who are likely smarter than me and have certainly been way more influential than I have, but the idea that the only examples of novels and plays that they have on tap are Shakespeare or, quote, countless romance novels, unquote, is just incredibly funny. I'm flip-flopping a bit on how I feel about novelists and playwrights rarely design their plots from scratch. I guess it's true, or at least truthy. I mean, what is the book Save the Cat, if not a pattern language for screenplays? That said, I don't think that design decisions in creative work follow automatically, though I guess I don't really think they do in OO design either. There's something about this analogy that feels like a category error. The romance novel does not feel to me like it is at the same level as represent states with objects. One feels like an entire work and one feels like a trope. Anyway, before I run away and come back with a romance novel theory of object-oriented design, the thesis of the actual book. 1. Seemingly disparate programs will have common patterns of logic or interaction. 2. By identifying these patterns and applying tried and true solutions to them, you end up with, well, I'll quote them, quote, design patterns help a designer get a design right faster, unquote. The innovation here is the idea that a pattern is a useful unit of design, both for the actual design and for reusing solutions in multiple problems. They don't really define what makes a design right in any rigorous way, but they suggest that patterns make a design quicker to establish, easier to reuse, and more consistent. I think the implication is that by using existing solutions, bugs will also be less frequent. I should note that the book is pretty explicit that this is just a sampling of the most commonly used patterns and that readers are encouraged to identify, name, and define common patterns in their own domain. I note that because it's a point that frequently got lost when people started to apply the book. All right, what's a pattern? All this is based on the writings of Christopher Alexander. Alexander was an architect and the co-author of the book A Pattern Language, written in 1977, which is where the term pattern language comes from. He coined the term. A pattern language isn't a language in the computer sense, but a common set of patterns that all share the same structure and interact with each other. The patterns become the way you discuss the design space, so they become a kind of language for talking about design. A pattern typically has a name, a problem that it's trying to solve, a description of a successful solution, and a cross-reference to related patterns. Per Wikipedia, Alexander's architecture patterns include things like a place to wait, with the problem being people need a place to exist while they wait for a thing to happen, and solution pieces presumably including seating and a television tuned to the most annoying news station available, I'm guessing. What I'm not quite sure about is when the ideas about useful and reusable structures in architecture started to cross-pollinate with software. But the early software pattern writers were pretty explicit that they were trying to adapt Alexander's work specifically. Let's talk about the structure of the book. There's a foreword by Grady Booch that is four paragraphs long and might have taken upwards of an hour to write. The book starts with the introduction containing the above quotes, some logistics, and then a bunch of sections on how patterns work and some general OO design stuff like inheritance versus composition. Then there's a case study building a WYSIWYG editor called Lexi and showing how patterns work to help design an editor like this. Looking at the case study, in some ways, it's a clearer statement of the author's priorities than the introduction is. The case study chapter is 44 pages long and has something like 20 different object diagrams or interface listings, some pseudocode, and basically zero lines of actual code logic. That's maybe unfair. There are code samples, but there are like if statements leading to constructors for classes that aren't shown, or straight up comments. Basically all the code is showing structural logic, not business logic. This is not a book for people interested in implementation details. It is about strategy, not tactics. That's fine. The book can be about structural logic, but using it does lead to a technical form of OO where classes tend to be defined by their role in the pattern rather than their role in the domain. Each pattern then gets a chapter with a consistent format with as many as 13 subsections ranging from name to sample code to known uses. We start with abstract factory, also known as kit, as in a class name like so would be something like user kit. Kit is a term that did not make it out of the 90s, but which is actually a lot easier to type than abstract factory, and good on me for writing a joke that forced me to type abstract factory again. And again, to give a sense of the timeline here, the motivation for the abstract factory pattern starts with, quote, consider a user interface toolkit that supports multiple look and feel standards, such as Motif and Presentation Manager. I've used abstract factory a lot, and I'm pretty sure that's no longer the main use case. I could cherry-pick stuff that didn't age well all day, like this consequence of abstract factory. Quote, extending abstract factories to produce new kinds of products isn't easy. That's because the abstract factory class fixes the set of products that can be created, by which they mean that it's a fixed set. That's true in C++, but it's not true in Ruby, and it wasn't even true in Smalltalk in 1994. You are all very narrowly escaping a 20-part series where I dissect each of the patterns one by one. Very narrowly. The fact is, though, that the discussions of the individual patterns are pretty thorough. There are implementation examples, pros and cons, uses in the wild, relations to other patterns. These discussions really do make you feel like you could start applying these patterns to your code immediately, which is where both the impact and the backlash come from. Because people did start applying these patterns to their code immediately, whether the code warranted it or not. Next section, impact. To start with the concrete impact, several of the patterns were explicitly incorporated into Java, either the language or the standard library, often using the same names. Smalltalk already had a lot of the patterns in its library. The book, in some sense, is a guide for how to do fun Smalltalk stuff in C++. I'm not 100% sure what the vector was to Java, though. None of the Gang of Four actually worked on Java itself, as far as I can tell. Eric Gamow was one of the co-creators of the JUnit test framework, and he also worked on Eclipse, which was one of the earliest Java IDEs. I think there was less impact on Python and Ruby, in part because those were further along than Java when the book came out. Also, Python and Ruby have a lot of the patterns built into their language or standard library, and already probably did when the book came out. Where the book was immediately successful was in changing the way people talked about their code. The naming of the patterns caught on, and people very much started to explicitly look for ways to incorporate the patterns into their code. Reaction. Let me tell a little story. In the year 2000, I started a new job. The company did back-end email server software, and the first thing my new team wanted me to do was review the current state of a new project. A team of five had worked on it for 6 months, and I cannot for the life of me remember what the project was. I do remember what they asked me to review. The deliverable was a binder. Five people, 6 months, and they had produced a design. And that's it. The design was a bunch of UML diagrams, and I'm sure it included a lot of design patterns. I don't remember what I said publicly, but I do remember what I thought privately, which is, wouldn't the project be in better shape if these people had already started coding something? Anyway, you can probably guess how this went. Basically, as soon as they started actual development, they realized that one of their requirement assumptions was wrong and most of the design was not usable. So, in my head, we have a classic thesis-antithesis. Thesis: using UML diagrams and doing a lot of design up front will improve program reuse. Antithesis: big design up front is often a waste of time. You are better off using that time to build code that is amenable to change. This technique, more or less, became agile. The line between the two groups isn't that clear-cut. Eric Gamow did work with Kent Beck on the early JUnit releases, but none of the Gang of Four are in the original Agile Manifesto group. Of course, by now the two have coalesced and we have a synthesis, whatever the heck teams do now that they call agileish and which waves in the direction of design patterns every now and then. The other kind of backlash was more on the execution side. Based pretty much solely on my own experience, this book tended to be interpreted in two incorrect ways. Way one, these 20 patterns are the only patterns that exist. Way two, a design could be evaluated solely on how many patterns it used. You see where this is going, or perhaps you are old enough to have been a professional in the 2000s and you lived it. Patterns everywhere! I'm sure I indulged in that myself. Designs just got too complicated, especially once it collided with everything must also be an interface design in Java. Eventually, you would have an explosion of classes that often existed either to just check a box for inclusion in a pattern or just to shuffle data around without any actual use or logic. Since the people misinterpreting the design patterns book tended to see this complexity as positive, it was nigh impossible to debate them out of the patterns. Current status. I don't see the book around as much anymore. Quite a high percentage of actual patterns like iterator or even abstract factory just became part of the way we talk about software. A few, like Chain of Responsibility or Memento, faded. But looking at the list of patterns, I've said that I've used or discussed about half of them in, say, the past year. That's not a bad contribution all by itself. What does seem to have faded is the idea that patterns will save us, or even that OO design will save us. As for the agile reaction, we will get to that next time. Thanks for listening.